Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddham dhammam sangham namassami. Kind of a dark shrine room reminds me of a story from Thailand where sometimes we'd have these very long meditations, and Ajahn Chah would then give very long talks, and most of us, me included, would get pretty restless as the talk went on and on and on. So the meditation might have been an hour, and the talk would go on for 2 hours, and my Thai was not very good. And we were sitting on concrete floors, and no cushions, and mosquitoes, and the whole experience of restlessness and wanting to get out of there, and so on. One day Ajahn Chah had been giving a rather long discourse, and all the candles had gone out. The only lighting we had in the meditation hall, this was in the evening, were the candles went out, and it was very, very dark. And we had this great big grandfather clock. All these monasteries had these big, tall grandfather clocks, which were always bonging away every quarter hour. And there was a new novice who had arrived from another monastery, and he was getting restless. And in the midst of this dark room, imagine this, this is a very, very dark room. You have this voice of Ajahn Chah going on, in the beginning inspiring, afterwards boring. And it's going on and on and on. And finally you see this beam of a flashlight turn on, and it shines on the grandfather clock. And everyone moaned because they knew Ajahn Chah would go on for another hour, because the guy kind of gave his cards away. He was restless, and so Ajahn Chah talked for another hour. I've never been able to do that. But there was a certain kind of teaching that we had in the monastery, of kind of just being stuck in a place of really not harmful in any way, but having no distraction and having nothing really interesting, and having a certain amount of discomfort, and just being there for hour upon hour. And the reflection was always the same: why do you suffer? What's the cause of suffering? What do you have to let go of? And that kind of forced situation, repeated again and again and again, where one is in a non-life-threatening situation, and it's socially very good, very wholesome, but I don't want to be here. The resistance, and the wanting to do something else, and then the criticism, and so on. And just seeing that day in and day out, day in and day out, and then finally saying, well, if you're going to stay here, you got to figure out how to be with this one. Not, because it's not going to change for you, Viradhammo. Thai Buddhism isn't going to change suddenly for your desires. And then taking responsibility for that, taking responsibility for the annoyance or the restlessness or the boredom, and no longer projecting it outwards, but seeing it, oh, okay, this is the suffering. So where is it coming from? And what do I need to let go? Where would peace lie in this situation? And I found that the repetition, say, of monastic life was incredibly helpful for that. Because if it was just a one-off that would happen to me, then I'd survive it or whatever, but I probably wouldn't get much insight. But just the kind of repetition of the same kind of attachment, the same kind of grasping, the same kind of resistance, and the same kind of thought patterns with the same people in the same situation, was very, very helpful. So variety wasn't helpful. Monotony was helpful. Our culture, of course, encourages variety, a constant stimulation of the sense experience, a constant Google searches for more information, you know, really interesting things that you can do, which is okay, which is fine. But to discover the peace of the mind sometimes requires a different kind of a situation. So if in your lives you have some kind of repeated patterns of discontent with your family or at work or with your own health, whatever it might be, do see those as kind of opportunities, because the repetition gives you a chance to look again and again and see what is the grasping here? Why can't, you know, why do I resist this? Or what's the fear? Or whatever the formation might be. And then with that kind of intention, that determination to take responsibility for the problem, then you begin to have a mind like I like the image of a field naturalist, a field ecologist or a field naturalist or a plant ecologist or a birder or any person who is looking at nature and trying to understand nature. Is the kind of quality of attention we're trying to cultivate to understand our own inner world. And if you think of like a plant ecologist or a field ecologist, they're in the environment and they're watching. They're noticing connections. A field naturalist needs a lot of patience. If you think about some of those movies we've seen on bird life or animal life, just the patience those photographers must have had to get one shot, right? Incredible shots. And if you think about, like, if you just go out to the pond here or you walk in the woods, to actually observe things, you have to be willing to be there. Now, you have a lot of annoying things like mosquitoes and deer flies and so on, which kind of distract you. And it's the same way with observing your own mind. There's a kind of a lot of sort of distractions and annoying things. And to actually have the capacity to stay composed and witnessing to your inner world is a kind of skill we're trying to develop, like a naturalist of your own mind. And these kinds of skills we do try to cultivate as we're meditating. The way in our teaching we talk about well-being, and it's usually talked about in sort of two manners. One is the way of well-being which is dependent on causes, and one is the way of well-being which is not dependent on causes. So the latter, of course, is enlightenment. But that the enlightened mind is oddly enough assisted by causes. You think about like the philosophy of Buddhism, Nibbana or enlightenment, these are the uncreated, the unoriginated, the unformed. That's the language you used. So you might think, well, how can anything which is created, like my emotions or my lifestyle, how could that be a foundation for the uncreated? I've kind of debated, oh, how could you have? Well, to actually understand the deepest parts of our spiritual life, you need a mind which can observe, which can stay attentive, which doesn't get distracted. And then from that undistracted mind, the deepest kinds of realizations are possible, the uncreated. So how do you create an undistracted mind? That's one way to think about it. And that undistracted mind, or that mind which is centered and present, and like the field naturalist mind, is rewarding in itself. You know, there's a certain beauty, isn't there, for you to be composed and centered. There's a sense of well-being in that, a sense of fulfillment. But that in itself is not the end. You know, it's a means. It's a means in Buddhism. So to create that environment, that inner possibility, the Buddha of course suggested all kinds of strategies. And in any of the lists that we get in Buddhism, in Theravada Buddhism, quite often many of the lists start with gratitude, or generosity. Generosity, gratitude, these are ways of cultivating a mind which has space in it. Like if you think about generosity is a quality where I don't need to get everything for myself. I've got extra. I can give to you. I've got space, I've got time, I've got resources, I can give to you. And it's that kind of generous mind which also is a mind which has a kind of certain stability because it doesn't need to get for itself all the time. A mind which is kind of very greedy or very frightened or very angry, it's always struggling with conditions, trying to get more from them or rejecting them or whatever. It doesn't have the kind of generosity of heart to be open, to be present, to give yourself. And in a sense, you have to give yourself to your own predicament. You have to give yourself to your own suffering to understand it. Because understanding is, it's like the naturalist. You have to wait, you have to watch, you have to observe, and then the insight will come. You can't just kind of bash away it and try to get rid of it or judge it. So generosity has always been a foundation for enlightenment. But generosity also is his own joy, to be able to give, like the Dana today, this lovely sharing of a meal. People came and offered food, and some people came from all the way from Toronto with obviously much preparation and hard work gone into it, is a very joyous thing, isn't it? That we could share a meal. And then that makes meditation much easier. Well, it makes it difficult because you fall asleep because the food's so good. That's one problem. Let's say in 2 hours. But it does, doesn't it? Like a generous heart is a heart which has a certain sense of fulfillment already. And if your heart feels fulfilled, then you can observe. If your heart doesn't feel fulfilled to some extent, then you're always trying to get something for yourself. And then you don't have that kind of stability of mind to observe. So generosity is a huge component of enlightenment, of the foundation for enlightenment. But generosity isn't an end, it's a means. So a person who is attached to generosity, who always needs an object of generosity to serve, can become a kind of a exhausted do-gooder, always needing to do good, to help and so on, which then is not really what the whole thing is about. But to be able to serve and to be able to give, like this is one of the things I often talk about my mother, is that to be able to help her to express generosity, I realize she really doesn't have much of that outlet. She doesn't have someone that she can give to. She tries to keep buying me things. I say, "Whoa, Mom, I'm a monk. I don't need much." But you can see she wants to express that too, because it's a joyous part of our life. So oddly enough, in Buddhism, people will offer the Sangha food, and then we express anumotana, we express joy at their generosity. And in Thailand, in Thailand you can't say thank you. A monk doesn't say thank you. And Thai say, no, thank you. I want to thank you for letting me give. Which is really lovely, isn't it? So a monk is not supposed to thank you. He says, I rejoice in your good merit. I rejoice in your good fortune. So you can see how generosity changes the mind, doesn't it? It changes the heart to a sense of fulfillment. But still we suffer, right? I mean, we can be very, very generous, but still, we can still suffer. We can still get upset or angry and so on. So that's not to dismiss it, but say, okay, that piece of our social life is important. We can put that in place. We can practice. We can train. Another image I have in meditation, which I often talk about, is a craftsperson. You know, someone who picks up a craft, a cabinet maker, a good cook, a weaver, whatever craft you think about, there has to be a kind of application of effort and skill and a development of that skill. There has to be, so if you combine these two, the field naturalist and the craftsperson, the craftsperson has those qualities of actually observing the whole project And then the skill of the craftsman is to channel that project, right? And then to develop that project, to develop the skills and the abilities to take the medium and mold it and create it into something quite beautiful. That takes a lot of patience, it takes a directed energy, it takes concentration, it takes an understanding of the materials used and so on. And that's also a good way, a good sort of analogy for developing the mind. So if we think about generosity, sometimes we just feel naturally generous. So that's a no-brainer, we're generous. Sometimes there's no room for generosity. The bear comes at the path and you don't share your jam sandwich with the bear. And, oh, here you go, little bear. I mean, you do something, you know, you're more cautious. So it's not time for generosity, time for caution or whatever. So sometimes, you know, generosity is very obvious. Sometimes it's just not appropriate or whatever. It's not available. We're too upset. But sometimes it's kind of available, but we don't want to do it. You know, maybe it's in like you're feeling grumpy, and the generous thing would be to put down the grumpiness and open to the person. But there's something petty in me that just wants to dump on them. And they say, good morning. You say, no, it's not. That's a lack of generosity. And that when we see that, we suffer regret, don't we? Yeah? And that's the area, like those areas where it's easy to be generous. It's not possible to be generous. The kind of middle way where we know it would be really neat if we could be generous, but we're not going to do it. We're stubborn or whatever. And those are the areas of training. Those are the interesting areas of training because we've got enough mindfulness. We got enough awareness to know, oh, if I could only just drop this ego, or if I could just be a bit more generous. And we struggle. Those are the areas we struggle. And that's where the craft is. Now, that's not a demand that we be generous. You know, I should be generous is not mindfulness. It's simply aversion to whatever's going on. But the seeing, like the field naturalist sees, okay, this is what's going on. And then the craft person, well, if I could just cut the wood that particular way, then I'd get a really nice curve on that. It's the same way with the heart. You know, there's this resistance in me to be generous. I just, you know, I'm in a bad mood or whatever. And I awaken to that mood and I don't go with that. I watch and I witness it and then I make a move towards generosity. That's done in full awareness and that's hard to do. But it's very rewarding. It's very, very rewarding. And that's the craft of the mind. Yeah? Now, we've all been, you know, as children, we're all taught that, you know, you should be generous, share your toys with Johnny or whoever, right? So there's a difference between I should be generous. We know that. And we know it's a good thing, not a bad thing. That kind of tyrannical demand we might make on ourselves to actually the craft of generosity, or that part of the craft of the heart. Huh? And that's the kind of thing we're working on as human beings. And taking those difficult bits and then not being able to express generosity where it would have been good, it would have been skillful, it would have been helpful. And then that's where repetition comes in again. You come back into that situation in that personal relationship or at the work or whatever, and you know the habit of grumpiness or cynicism or put downness, and you keep trying and trying, and one day you don't go with the negative, and you have the skill of right speech, or you pause on the negative, and you begin to cultivate the heart. You craft the heart in a way which is quite joyous. So that in itself is rewarding, but what it's doing, it's also developing this capacity for us to make choices. You know, when I can do that, when I'm conflicted, and I have enough awareness in that conflict, right? I'm not just overburdened by it. I have enough awareness in that conflict, and I can shift from one to the other. I can make a skillful shift. I make a choice now, quite a conscious choice towards mindfulness, towards letting go of ego, letting go of selfishness, letting go of greed, hatred, delusion. That very skill, beyond the rewards of the result of that skill, that very skill is a skill we use for enlightenment. Because that's what you need. You need a mind which is flexible, which is adaptable, which can make choices. make skillful choices, rather than the mind is just reactive all the time to whatever sort of thrown at us. Like our social life, of course, is also not only is it guided by generosity, it also has to be guided by ethics. So that's a kind of another huge area that we develop skill. And so the kind of ethical principles of Buddhism, of nonviolence and non-destruction and non-corruption and fidelity and sobriety and those kinds of things, are a foundation for enlightenment. They are socially, they're a protection. The precepts that we take, the moral precepts that we take, they're a protection from those impulses in our own heart which are very unskillful and very harmful to ourselves and others. So a person, the example I always like to bring up is that there was a 30 years, I think, after the My Lai massacres in Vietnam, there was a British documentary. It wasn't American, it was a British documentary of how those massacres happened. And you'll remember that the whole battalion of Americans went crazy in the village and killed a lot of, just gunned down a lot of people in the most vicious way. And they went to two people. One was they were both from the American South, and both were involved in that platoon. And one man had, he had got lost in it. He had just kind of, he was just shooting women and children right, left, and center. And the other person that they interviewed hadn't got lost in the bloodlust, and had just shot his machine gun or whatever into the sand, into the dirt. Couldn't do it. And they interviewed these two. Very interesting. They're going to interview these two characters. And the one who had gotten lost in the bloodlust, in the killing, was on all manner of overprescribed drugs and alcohol, and was a total mess. Was just a complete mess emotionally and physically. And was full of regret and remorse and bad dreams and couldn't sleep and the rest of it. The other person, who had had a strong Christian upbringing, knew it was wrong. Had a sense of moral integrity, a moral boundary. And he said, "This is wrong." That's what he kept saying to himself. And the interviewer said, "Well, why didn't you follow everyone else?" He says, "Because I knew it was wrong. I knew it was wrong. I knew I couldn't do this." And his life was one where he wasn't filled with regret and remorse. You know, he had quite a healthy mind. And that was really interesting, how a moral framework is a protection. So that when the forces of delusion arise in among peers or in our own minds, we have this kind of moral protection. So the precept of not killing and not stealing and so on are that kind of moral protection. So socially they protect us and protect our society, and inwardly as a foundation for enlightenment, an ethically life which is ethically profound, I would say, you know, which doesn't take living in this world lightly, which considers seriously our actions and speech. A life lived that way is a life which is free from remorse. It's free from regret and remorse and all the egotism and whatever that can come up from that, all the self-hatred and so on. So that you could see as a foundation for enlightenment, that if my mind is freed from remorse, if I've done my very best to act and speak in ways which are not harmful to myself and others, then that remorseful mind has no real food. And because it has no food, the mind has a stability. You know, it can abide. So that field naturalist part of our mind can really look at things rather than being caught by the different things. It can look and it can observe. So that sort of ethical background of Buddhism is tremendously important, always has been, and gives us a kind of moral compass in the world and a heart which is freed from remorse. So those two, generosity and morality or ethics, they sort of are the passive and active of our social life. The Generosity is the active, and the moral boundaries is the passive. So I might feel the impulse to kill, but I don't do it. That's so I still am I'm mindful of this, but I'm mindful enough to make a choice not to do it. I feel the impulse to serve, and it's appropriate. I serve, I give. That's active. So there's the impulses of harm that come up. They do come up. It's just part of being human. But we don't have to act on them. And again, you can see how making ethical choices, making choices towards generosity, what's developing in the mind is a kind of capacity not just to be hoodwinked and reactive, but to choose, to think in a certain way, to act in a certain way, to speak in a certain way. And so the foundation for that investigative mind becomes stronger, is strengthened by that. Whereas a reactive mind, which is just reacting with wrong speech, and so on, is a mind which has quite a lot of confusion. It suffers. Like you just think about right speech. If one a person is just reactive with speech and divisive and cruel, their mind can never realize enlightenment because their mind is just too caught up with all kinds of memories and regret and remorse and doesn't know how to make skillful choices. Doesn't know is too much wrapped up with things. So that's always been the social foundation for Buddhism, and I'm sure you all know that, but it's always good to remember that, because Buddhism as just meditation in itself, of course, wouldn't be Buddhism; it'd just be meditation in itself. So it's good to remember that kind of framework that we live within. So meditation, then, if you consider what one of the things we're trying to do in meditation, we're trying to if you look at what happens in much of our life, off of the cushion, much of our life, as I was saying after lunch, is spent in anticipation. If you consider this week or any day in any week, how much of it is spent in mental anticipation? Not just skillful planning, but just anticipating. You think, what am I going to say to that person, and how am I going to do that? What if that happens? This kind of anticipating in the mind. Part of our mental energy is taken up, our attention is taken up with that. Part of our attention is taken up with sense distraction. You know, we're just absorbed into a piece of literature or a piece of music or some food or talking with someone. So our minds are kind of always consuming. Even when we're like thinking about we're fantasizing about going to Thailand and visiting Ajahn Chah's monastery or something, or going on Buddhist pilgrimage. That's a really good thing, isn't it? So if we're sitting here fantasizing about going on Buddhist pilgrimage, we're still consuming. You know, we're consuming thought. We're eating thought, as it were. So the mind is still engaged with sense objects. So that's part of the way our mind gets taken up, the mental energy taken up, the time gets taken up. So there's anticipation. There's the participation in sense experience, eating and drinking and so on. And then there's the critical mind. You know, so much of our time can be taken up with always criticizing and judging and analyzing and finding fault and looking at differences. So the mind, again, is preoccupied. It's preoccupied with thought. It's preoccupied with judgment. And it needs to be. That's okay. I mean, you need to use your analytical mind for whatever. But you can see the mind, which is like engaged in all those ways, has no space. It has no space for any new insight. It's simply doing what it does. So it's either anticipating, thinking, or it's consuming, or it's judging or analyzing, and so the mind gets very, very busy. Or our awareness is taken up with all kinds of activity, and there's no space. So when we meditate, what we're trying to do, we're trying to put down anticipation. So the suggestion in the meditation, just listen. But listen with a mind which isn't listening for a particular sound. Now, if I'm listening for a particular sound, is that a car over there? Or is someone in the workshop? Then I'm going out to the object. What's going on? So the object is important. But here, in listening, it's not the object, it's the listening. So we're emphasizing the listening, the being here. Yeah. So that's you're not anticipating the sound. It just this is the way it is. You might anticipate the end of the sitting if your knee is hurting. And that's anticipation. So your knee starts to hurt. When is it going to end? I have to go to the toilet. When is it? The mind starts to anticipate. And then you come back. I'm just listening. This is what anticipation feels like. So what are we doing in meditation? We're creating a kind of spacious awareness. Yeah? You're not consuming. We're not eating food. We're not looking at the internet. We're not answering emails. You know, we're not planning a trip somewhere. We're not engaged in sense experience in that usual way. We're allowing sense experience just to be what it is. The breath is as it is. Sound is as it is. The body feels this way. The posture is this way. We might use some of that. We might use the posture to energize, but it's not from consumption. We're not reacting to the pleasure and pain principle. Consumption is we're reacting to pleasure and pain. We don't like the harsh sound. We look for the pleasant sound. We look at the food. We like the pleasant one. We don't like that one. I don't like hot chilies. I'll take this one. I'm a vegetarian. I'll take that one. I like meat. I'll take that one. We're choosing. We're choosing on pleasure and pain. So our minds are choosing. In this kind of, say, if you're just listening, you're not choosing the object. You're being that which knows. And that's different. That's much different. Not consuming. Not anticipating. Not criticizing. So, like, you're sitting and you're not trying to analyze sound or the body or the mind. You're just allowing this to reveal itself. You're allowing conditions to be as they are. So you're putting down the critical, judgmental, analytical mind. You can use it. You can use it. You can say, well, what if I try a bit deeper breathing? You can use that. But your mind isn't consumed by the critical mind. You're using the critical mind just a little bit. Just a little bit. As opposed to the mind is always judging and analyzing and being very, very busy mentally. So these three things, you're putting them down. Anticipation. The absorption into sense experience through consumption, and that kind of constant critical judging, analyzing, thinking mind, you're putting it down into what? Into just this very, very simple sense of presence with an object, the breath, sound, metta, whatever, and just trying to abide as that kind of awareness for the span of an in-breath and the span of an out-breath. And that's hard to do. Because those other things keep pulling you. But you can see how that creates a whole different tone in one's life, where the mind isn't busy going to the future. It's not busy trying to get something. It's not judging. It's resting. It's resting in space. It's resting in emptiness, right? It's not preoccupied. And that resting mind, then, what does that do? That gives the possibility for something new to arise. As long as my mind is preoccupied with thinking and becoming and all of that, how can there be anything fresh? It can be just a regurgitation of the old, a reaction from one to the other. But when the mind has that kind of sense of restfulness and openness, then that field naturalist can really function. So the mind is restful and is observing cause and effect, how it works. And that's how insight works. You don't get insights. You don't kind of pre-plan an insight. You know, all of us have had some insights, right? We might not have halos on our heads, but we've all seen something. You know, we've understood something about our minds, something about our bodies. We've had some insight. And how did that work? Didn't it just sort of happen? Well, we laid the foundation. We laid the foundation of observation, attentiveness, you know, non-distraction, and so on. But the particular way an insight arises, you don't know. It's like the field naturalist goes out into the field and observes and has some idea, and it's like those red-winged blackbirds in the nests I noticed, I talked about last week. I noticed 6 nests in one territory. Now, whoa, what's that? How could that be? I thought birds were territorial, so they have one nest, you know, and they have their territory. And then I read in the books later that the male red-winged blackbird has a territory of nests. So he has several females in that territory. And the thing they've done in DNA tests, they found that the eggs aren't all fertilized by him, by the way. There's something else going on. But anyway, that noticing of six nests in one little reed bank, I didn't know I'd see that. I had no idea. I just went out to the field and I watched. Had my binoculars and I paddled around and the a few bugs and just watched. And then, ah, look at that. And that's really interesting. That's the way insight works. You don't know. I mean, you read the books, right? But the books are kind of abstract of how the mind works, and you have to make it specific to your life, don't you? And so insight is this wonderful kind of capacity that exists in human consciousness, in the wisdom mind, if we give it a chance. If we don't give it a chance, if we're always just judging and anticipating, and if we're always distracted, there's no chance. There's only old habits which just reinforce themselves and get stronger. So that kind of spaciousness and the capacity to observe and witness. And then you combine that with the craft, right? That once you have some insight into any aspect of your behavior, of your mind, or whatever, you hone the craft. Why? Because you have the insight. It's not just someone else's idea. It's not just coming from some sense of Buddhist duty that I must be a good person or I must be generous. It's a real insight. Oh, yeah. So how could I do that? So even though you have some insight into your own behavior, into what leads to peace and what leads to confusion, even though you have that insight, you're still stuck with the habits, unfortunately. Insights don't wipe out habit. They simply give you an entry into the wise understanding of habit, and then the skillfulness of the craftsperson then begins to hone that insight and really work with it. So if I have a particular kind of issue with someone or particular habit pattern that is really causes me suffering, causes others suffering, I see that, then I make a determination from that insight. Okay, when that arises, I'll try to be more aware. I'll try to be aware of my body. I'll say agatha, whatever. I'll develop some kind of craft skill around that. And that's really neat. You know, it's really like it's your life, and it's your craft, and now you're taking it on in a way where you're not just the victim anymore, the victim of circumstance or the victim of a childhood patterns or whatever it might be. Look, I can change the mind. I can change perception. I can make choices of thought. And this is wonderful. This is really, really wonderful. And then we get overwhelmed and then we can't do it, but we awaken again. And so you get the sense of craft evolving. And so meditation has its own rewards too. Just as generosity has its own rewards, just as a life lived in impeccability has its rewards, so also a life of meditation has its own rewards, but it's not the end. It's a means. That kind of stillness of mind or openness of consciousness which you touch in meditation, you can attach to that. And if you attach to that, then you begin to hate anything that interrupts that. And then you're stuck. You're attached to tranquility. So it's a means, not an end in itself. One of the most profound crafts and skills that the teaching is encouraging us to develop are the crafts of the open heart, I like the word empathy most. It's the word that really kind of fits what these open-hearted practices are about. And if you think about compassion, kindness, mudita, that empathetic joy that we can have, or like the field naturalist has a kind of equanimity about nature. The field naturalist is not a sentimentalist. You know, sentimentality is thinking, oh, my God, the heron just ate the baby frog. Oh, dear. And you'd never see a field naturalist go out there and start crying for the baby frog. The field naturalist say, herons eat frogs. This is life. Huh? This is the way it goes. So that kind of equanimity is a part of the open heart. That kind of ability to see, yeah, there is suffering. I do suffer. This person suffers. And then the compassion comes from the equanimity. Sentimentality is not usually open-heartedness. Look at the sentimentality around someone, let's say, if a big pop star dies. Look at the emotion there. That's just, you know, unless it's the family and people very close, it's usually just sentimentality, a kind of indulgence in in oh me or my. Look at the grief of someone who's lost their child in Gaza. That's grief. That's real grief, isn't it? That's like 150% grief. Whereas sentimentality is different. That's not, that's usually, that's quite often kind of emotional indulgence. And the heart practices are not emotional indulgence. They are authentic empathy. When I see someone, and like if I'm with a disabled person and I feel sorry for them, oh you poor thing, that's not really, you know, that's patronizing sentimentality. But to actually put myself in that person's shoes, and I say, yeah, that'd be a tough practice. I wonder how I'd do in there. You know, that's a whole different kind of mind, isn't it? You're trying to be with that person in the way they are. That's different. So empathy, if you think about empathy, empathy is the opposite of selfishness. Right? It's not like patronizing attitude, oh, I'm glad I'm not like that. Or, oh, you poor thing, you know, that's selfish. Whereas empathy is like, wow, that's a tough practice. I wonder how you do. How do you do that? You know, you're really with the person. You want to understand the person. Like mudita, the empathy of joy, beautiful quality. You say if you're taking care of someone who's 93 years old and who doesn't get out of the, who gets out of the apartment once a year to go see the eye doctor who gives the same diagnosis, hopeless. And then you have a garden on the balcony and this little old person gets on that garden half an hour a day, and for them it's like going to Thailand. You know, it's such a huge experience. You know? This is my mother. And so she's on the garden and she's looking at the flowers, and that is such a joyous thing. It's her joy, but it's my joy too. Now I could lose that joy by thinking, oh, I've got to do the dishes, and then I've got to water the plants, and I'd lose that joy. But empathy would be, this person is happy. I'm gonna plug into that happiness. It's a wonderful human quality. It's the opposite of jealousy, it's the opposite of envy. You know, that someone says they are going on pilgrimage to India and say, oh, I'm jealous of you. Well, why? Why not just be happy for them? Much, you know, much, much more beautiful. So empathy is one of the things that really make us happy. When I understand what empathy is and I connect to the world, not sentimentality, yeah? I connect to the world both empathetically of the heart and also with equanimity when I understand cause and effect, there's a tremendous amount of peace and openness. And that peace and openness is a foundation for enlightenment. Because if the heart's not open, then quite often our efforts at enlightenment are head-centered, are willful, are geared towards getting rid of things. They don't have that kind of openness of the heart. Heart's very, very important. Otherwise, it's kind of a head trip. And so there, I think this very profound kind of practice, as the Buddha suggested to us, is that we cultivate an attitude to all sentient beings. May all beings be free from suffering. A kind of golden rule. Now, if you think about the golden rule, I will do unto others as I will do unto others as I would have done unto me. I will not do unto others that which I would not have done to me. That's a really neat way to relate to people. So someone dumps on me. Right, let's say someone insults me, and I feel it. Right? I it's not nice to be insulted. And what do? I say, I'm going to get them back. Revenge? Not a good idea. Or, oh, it's not fair. Or I say, I take the golden rule. I say, I don't like this. I'm not going to do it to others. That's wonderful. And that's mindful. And that gets back to this capacity we have to make choices. You know, so someone insults me, and now I've trained myself in speech and thought, and the impact is still not nice. You know, I'm still a human being. I don't like to get dumped on, unless I'm some kind of whatever. Sometimes Buddhists think, you know, if you're really wise, you're not feeling anything. Nonsense. You still feel it. So there it is, and there's the feeling. What do you do with it? What choices do I make? Do I make the choices of engaging in it in a way which causes me and the other person suffering, revenge or self-hatred or whatever? Or do I say, this hurts, this is what it hurts, and I'm not going to do it to others? It's a golden rule. That's empathy, isn't it? It's empathetic. And And that brings actually a sense of ease to the heart. Those kinds of practices. And these don't come automatically. They're part of the craft, aren't they? They're part of the whole skill of the Buddhist contemplative meditative lifestyle. And the rewards are very real, but again, the rewards are a foundation for enlightenment. So that the openness of the heart then, in the various ways of empathy, then you can see that the whole human consciousness now is sort of has a foundation. It is grounded in goodness, right? The heart is open to the way things are. The intellect is clear. It can make choices, but it can make choices from skill rather than from reaction. So all the equipment is there. And then you take the deeper teachings on not self, on emptiness, on the unconditioned, uncreated, and you begin to make that a kind of contemplative koan in your spiritual life, unconditioned. And that's not something you figure out with thought, right? But something you can move to, and then you start to move to the silence of the mind, you inquire into that. But it all requires a really good foundation, doesn't it? And that work is rewarding in itself and beautiful. All right? I'll leave that for your reflection. Sadhu.